Well, we're going to take your phone calls next with our special guest, Joe Nickel, on Coast to Coast AM. Joe, before we take any calls, let's get on to Roswell and get your take on that. 1947, something happened there, right?
Good.
Okay.
I've been to the Mac Brazel Ranch, what's left of it.
I've been out in the area trying to find it when I was at the Roswell.
We did a lot of driving before we found up the old building to Brazel's Ranch. Yes, something happened, and I tell people the best way, because if you wait years until people have become old men and their memories are confused and they've shared data and got it garbled with other data, and there have been hoaxers all over the place with Roswell, one hoax after another hoax. The best thing, one of the things that people can do is, and anybody can do this really, is just go back in time to the actual date and go to the Roswell Daily Record newspaper. And Mac Brazel came into town and said he found something strange on his property, and he describes it. And people, I have to take my word for it, they can read it for themselves. Mm-hmm. And he describes foiled paper, sticks, string, tape, and rubber. And that did not, the first time I read it, did not sound to me like an extraterrestrial craft. It sounded like a box kite to me. And as I read it over the years, it sounds more and more like something like a box kite.
Well, how did
I think it's a corner radar reflector.
How did it get blown out of proportion with the alien bodies then?
Well,
things like that.
Keep in mind that Mac Brazel, the guy now whose property was, who found it, who came into town and told about it, he never said, ever, ever, ever in his life, he never said, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you about those alien bodies. I was so busy telling you about the tape and the sticks and the string, I forgot to mention those bodies. I mean, people ought to be able to use a little common sense and realize that the original story didn't have these alien bodies in it. They didn't have an extraterrestrial craft. What happens is that years later, when there's this huge folklore has developed about extraterrestrial bodies being hidden away at Hangar 18 or some other secret site, and that man, a man named Carr, made those stories up. I mean, I've talked to his son, and his son told me how he would sit in the back of auditoriums and cringe while his father told these expansive lies. Over time, this all gets mixed together, and the hoaxers are everywhere talking about they've seen things and so forth. People get attention by saying, you know, when I was in the military, I saw something. It's too awful to talk about. Don't ask me. And, of course, what do? Oh, please, tell us more. And now they're the center of attention, and they're privy to special knowledge. Well, there are a lot of people who get attention by doing this. And people at Roswell, some of the people involved, have misremembered what happens. And some of those facts have been checked out. Stories about nurses and coffins with little, you know, for little bodies and stuff. The stories have been pretty well checked out. They didn't happen at the time that the Roswell incident happened. These are things that might have happened years later, and people have gotten confused. The same way I get confused when I go back and try to write about something 30 years ago or something, and I've a few times gone back to one of my daily journals that I kept at the period or something and found out I had it pretty well misremembered as to which came first, the two incidents and so forth. Our memories are just not very, very perfect. So I have talked personally to Charlie Moore from Project Mogul, and Charlie Moore has looked at the photographs. The photographs from Roswell, all the photographs that people see that the conspiracy theorists think have been switched, those pictures match what Mac Brazel described. And Charlie Moore has looked at them, and he said, yeah, that's corner radar reflectors and remains from a Project Mogul secret United States government spy balloon.
All right.
I think that's what crashed at Roswell, and I think the alien bodies and all that are later development. The descriptions of the bodies that you hear of the little big-eyed, big-headed humanoids, those images of aliens weren't current in 1947. That's where the guy who made the alien autopsy film, that fake dissection of an alien.
Oh, yeah, we know him well, Bob Kiviat.
Yes, and well, he didn't make it.
He was the executive producer of it.
Yes, yes. And, you know, that they made a mistake there by using this sort of standard alien creature that hadn't been really developed in our folklore yet. And they've cast it back in 1947. And that was a tip-off. When I first saw that movie, I not only thought, you know, this alien is too modern. You know, this is the modern idea of what an alien looks like. And it'd be a great coincidence that real aliens look like this sort of folkloristic process. And there were other anachronisms with that movie. I'm sure you're familiar. And the guy that made it is in England is now confessed and shown how he did it. So, but there just been one hoax after another with Roswell, and it's the best evidence, in my opinion, is that Brazel described honestly what he saw. It was very lightweight. He dragged the bulk of it into a shed with his tractor. Foiled paper sticks and string. These were corner radar reflectors hanging from a Mogul spy balloon array of balloons and radar reflectors. With Discovery Channel, I was part of a project that recreated that effect and brought it down, crashed it, and showed the debris and so forth, just as an experiment to recreate that. And that's what I think is the best evidence and the best answer.
All right, let's go to the phones. You ready?
Sure.
We'll pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, how are you, George?
I'm fine, thank you.
Joe, with all due respect, it seems to me that you just want to debunk anything that doesn't fit your idea of reality.
Why does it seem like that?
Well, because not everything can be proven.
Oh,
and I happened to be in Point Pleasant around the time that this happened with your so-called owl.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I can assure you what those people encountered was not an owl.
You can assure me of that. Did you see it?
I was born and raised in this area.
Did you see it?
I did not see it, but I had good friends who did, and it was no owl.
And your friends couldn't have made a mistake or been mistaken?
Well, not all of them, because not all of them knew each other, and they all described the same thing. This thing was much too big to be any kind of bird.
Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it looked just like a bird and had the glowing
eyes.
No,
it didn't. It didn't look like a bird.
Well, then the drawings that the people made at the time and their evidence is mistaken. You can't have it both ways.
Well, but also there were a number of people who were aggravated constantly after this with harassing phone calls and visits from people, or I say people in quotes, who were obviously not human beings. One called himself Indrid Cole. I think that was in John Keel's book. This little guy.
Yeah, I'd take all that with a big, big, big grain of salt. And,
but I know several people who the man was in their home,
mm-hmm.
along with another strange-looking guy. The gal that was the reporter for the newspaper got all kinds of strange calls on her phone. And this happened for several years after the event.
Well, who do you think? I've never understood the logic of how now Mothman is what, an extraterrestrial being, but somehow is able to dial up people on the phone
play
pranks
that,
or what?
I'm not saying that at all.
Well, give me some kind of very short scenario that makes any kind of sense to a sane person.
The only thing I can tell you is this creature was seen by people that I know to be honest to God, sane human
okay,
beings.
Okay, but you're talking about now other strange people. You're calling
exactly.
them people, but they're strange and they're making phone calls.
This started happening. After,
what's that got to do with Mothman?
Well, it all began at the same time.
Well, sure it did.
And these people started seeing what they called UFOs.
But don't you think that just like today, when we're in this Drew Peterson case, and people are calling or sending letters anonymously and claiming they've seen her and so forth, don't you think that there's a kind of bandwagon effect that once a case gets some celebrity, all kinds of kooks and cranks come out of the woodwork claiming this and claiming that, making up stories? I mean, we know for a fact that they do. They did it with Roswell. People claimed with Roswell, you know, that they had seen the alien creatures and had a diary to prove it, had written about it in their diary. They had the diary to prove it.
Well,
trouble is, when forensic experts tested the ink hadn't been made in 1947.
I disagree.
See, the problem that we investigators have.
I disagree with you about that, too. But the point here is these people were not kooks. They were salt of the earth people who had lived in that area all their lives.
Yes, and I do agree with you that it's unfortunate how people are often treated. I have not treated those people that way. When I was in Point Pleasant, I heard people taking a very different view from yours, sneering about some of the people probably smoking pot and making other statements, and they don't know that, and I don't think it's necessary to say it. I've not said it. I give people the benefit of the doubt. I take it that they saw something, they described something, they didn't recognize what it was. I think they mistook the size of it. I rest my case that the McClintock Wildlife Area, which I'm sure you know, has, and I can certify this, there are barred owls in that place and were there at that time, and they look a lot like Mothman under those conditions, and the only real difference is the size of the creature. But I understand that there are people who have, you know, saw something, and I'm not going to convince them, I'm sure, and I may be mistaken. That's always possible. I'm willing to look at any evidence or any new evidence in the Mothman case.
Will we ever get evidence, Joe, to prove these things one way or another?
Well, see, I think sometimes we do. I mean, I certainly think that science has proven the Shroud of Turin is a medieval forgery. I think we can just declare that. We've got tempera paint. We've got, you know, forensic tests of internationally known forensic experts testing the blood. We've got the radiocarbon dating. I mean, at some point, we have to quit saying, oh, it's controversial and we don't really know. No, actually, we know. If this were an artifact that weren't a holy prize for a certain group of people, it would have been case closed, you know, decades ago. But some cases where we don't have, I mean, with Mothman, what do we have? We have now only the memory, which is almost surely faulty, of the people there. I tried to get an interview with in the Flatwoods case of the beautician, and I talked to her son, and he was not wanting to talk to a skeptic.
I wonder if Frank Fescino had a chance to talk with that person.
Oh, yeah,
because
they were willing to tell their story to somebody who's going to blow this story into a big, huge something, and not willing to talk to somebody who might actually be able to explain it. I think that's exactly what happened, but the gentleman told me, in refusing, you know, to talk to me further, said my mother no longer knows what she saw. I think that's interesting, because she, you know, it's so many years went by, and I mean, you know, if you saw something for a few moments, I mean, just literally a few moments, and were frightened by it, and over time, people have shown you drawings or talked to you and asked you to imagine this and that, and you've maybe had dreams and so forth. After all these years, how accurate are you going to be? I think in those cases, we go back to the best evidence. In the case, for example, at Flatwoods, is some of those early newspaper accounts and drawings when this was still fresh in the minds of people. Let me mention just real quickly one other thing at Flatwoods. I talked to the man that did this. He went up in that night, went up in his pickup truck and drove all around the area and came back. Then saw nothing. The next day, people were finding up there in that area, they were finding skid marks apparently from a UFO, some kind of mysterious black gunk that was not explained and so forth. And he kept trying to tell people that that was his pickup truck made those skid marks, and that was oil from his leaking from his oil pan of his Ford pickup. And he tried to tell people that they wouldn't listen to it. And that has gotten into the literature since then, and he took me up there and recreated his drive around and everything, and I'm absolutely convinced that those elements can be explained and were explained at the time. It's amazing how people just will add anything to these stories and keep the stories going and blow them up.
All right, let's go back to some of the calls. International Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello? Are you there? I guess not.
Oh, this may be one of those mystery figures from...
Disappears.
Off me.
All right, next up, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Kevin in Tempe. Hi, guys.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Joe, I love you. You know, I've suspected for years that this was the case with the Shroud because of the burial techniques and what you said, and had done some investigation myself, you know, what I'm able to investigate. So let me go a step beyond that subject a little bit. Have you checked into or heard of the cloth of Oviedo or the veil of Veronica, which the Vatican claims to have?
Right, and these are complex issues, but they are both covered, and I'm saying this to be helpful, not to sell a book. I do have a new book out called Relics of the Christ. And the cloth of Oviedo and the Veronicas, the multiple shrouds, the Shroud of Turin, all these are discussed along with, you know, the Holy Blood. I've been to Bruges, Belgium, and held in my hands the Holy Blood of Christ, alleged. And I take a look at each of these. But the cloth of Oviedo, that people are trying to equate it with the so-called napkin or face cloth of that John mentions. Trouble is, and they're trying to link it to the Shroud of Turin with the same pseudoscience that they use for the one they're using for the other. But the fact is, if there was a face cloth over Jesus's face, that would have blanked out the face on the Shroud image. I mean, there's just some people can think this through. If you put a separate cloth over the face and then drape the cloth and the body leaves an image, the face image is going to be on the underneath cloth, the napkin that's directly in contact with the face. But, you know, it's just amazing to look at the Shroud studies that are done and the theories that are put out there and the false information. It's breathtaking.
Sure is. Joe, people, can they email you?
I don't have email, and I have to say I can't answer personal queries one-to-one. That's why I write books. If I simply wrote everybody a polite note telling them that I'm really busy, I wouldn't get any work done. I just don't do that.
All right, stay with us. We're going to be right back with you, Joe. We're going to take final phone calls. Also, I want to ask you about those Nazca lines in Peru. You can only make them out from above. Were they made by ancient astronauts? We'll find out. On our next Coast to Coast program, if you're for guns or against guns, that's what tomorrow's topic is going to be. It should be a very explosive show. Well, Eric Von Daniken made these things very famous, those Nazca lines in Peru, Joe. What's your take on those?
Well, they're certainly remarkable, and I've had the opportunity to fly over them in Peru. And
they make sense when you fly over them, don't they?
They do. These are very, very large drawings. And in 1982, I believe it was, I recreated the giant condor, which is 440 feet long, breathtakingly large. And I used sticks and string and a crew of about six of us.
And whereabouts?
Just on a landfill area in Kentucky.
Okay.
Just a big flat area. And I gulped when I marked off the 440 feet long distance, but we did a very good recreation, and Scientific American said it was my copy was remarkable in its exactness to the original. Recently, a year or so ago, I made another one for National Geographic, which was filmed as I made it and shown on the National Geographic television. And I made the giant spider, and it was even easier to do. I have an even simpler way of doing it. But basically, these are not that hard to make. They're sort of like crop circles. If you've never made one, you think they're just awe-inspiring and nobody could possibly go out and make one. If you've made one, you realize that anything you can draw on paper with a straight edge and a drawing compass, you can make crop circles. And I have shown how the Nazca lines could have been made. I don't know for sure how they were made, but I have made them using simple material.
All right, but what about the why they were made?
Well, that's, to me, exciting, because I think we now know some things about Nazca. Let me mention just quickly two facts that people can observe if they look at these giant drawings. One is they're drawn with a continuous line. That is, imagine the sort of giant pencil goes down, and it never leaves the sketch pad until it gets back to where it began. That's an unusual characteristic because the drawings of the Nazca Indians on their pottery and so forth are not drawn with a continuous line. And the second factor is that every figure, or just about every figure that I know of, has a pair of extraneous lines. There are two lines that go, for example, up to the base of the monkey's tail. There are two lines that lead off from the lower right leg of the spider, and so on. Now, it's just a fact that if you were, and these on the ground look like walking paths because the gravel has been cleared to expose the lighter earth. That's how the lines are made. So they look like a path has been swept in the gravel, and you could actually literally walk these paths, walk a line. If you walk one of these extraneous lines, you will continue and traverse the entire figure and come back out the other line. And I have racked my brains, and I suggest now that, and I'm not the first to have suggested this, but I'm promoting the idea that these were certainly ritual walking paths. Whatever else they were meant to be walked. Those extraneous lines have no purpose as far as the anatomy of the figures, or they're not used as layout or sketch lines of any kind and so forth. I've had a lot of experience with this sort of thing. These are entrance and exit lines, I'm convinced, until somebody comes up with a better explanation. But that's how I explain them now. And I expect the rituals probably had to do with the thing that the Nazcas were most desperate to have, and that was water. There's a very good book by Anthony Avini on the Nazca lines I recommend to people. He's a great scholar.
Okay, let's go to the phones. First-time caller line. Hi there. Thanks for holding.
Hello. Hi, George. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to know if you ever encountered or heard of a case about a djinn, which is a creature made of fire in the Middle East. It's a mythology in the Middle East and been mentioned in the Al-Quran. I was just wondering if you ever heard of them or...
No, not something I've come across. There are all kinds of mystical creatures, many of them just... You know, on the face of them, these are just products of mythology, folklore, legend. My concern is with those where there is some considerable evidence, maybe even a very lot of evidence, though I would say maybe not very good evidence, just a lot of it, for creatures like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and lake monsters like Champ and others. Those are the ones I'm mostly looking at. I'm trying to explain those things that are getting the attention and that need to be explained and where there appears to be some evidence and that one can actually investigate. Very hard to investigate a mythical being in some distant land unless there is some, you know, presumption that it actually exists and is causing some trouble. And then that's where I come in.
Okay, let's go next to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Good morning. Good morning, Joe and George.
Yes, sir.
How you doing?
Hi.
I'd like to challenge you, Joe, on the shroud, but first I just want to put a comment. You mentioned that you have gone to many places of so-called haunted houses, and I didn't know if you'd ever watched or or maybe you want to tag along with those guys on Ghost Hunters, Jay and
Jason and Grant.
I think the Ghost Hunter types, and there are many of these around the country, are on a fool's errand. I think they are using pseudoscience big time. They do not know what they're doing. These electromagnetic detection devices don't detect ghosts. They have nothing to do with ghosts. There's no scientific evidence of ghostly energy, electromagnetic or not. These instruments go off with faulty wiring or microwave towers. These guys absolutely are using equipment for a purpose for which it's not.
I was just going to point out,
not science.
I was just going to point out, though, that they go in with the same attitude as you to disprove things.
I don't believe that. I mean, I know that's, they say that they're trying to disprove it, but if you watch their shows, you see very quickly that they come upon a thing or two and they say, well, of course, we've disproved a lot. In other words, that gives us credibility. We've only found these few remarkable cases, and here's this remarkable evidence, and this is genuine. They don't actually have any scientific evidence of anything. They've not found anything published in any scientific journals. They've done nothing except, you know, find things they really don't know the explanation for, and they're using, therefore, the classic argument from ignorance. They're saying, I don't know what it is, therefore, it must be a ghost, or it might be a ghost.
I wanted to get to the shroud thing, but I just thought maybe you should check out that lighthouse in Florida where they had good evidence, I thought, on film and EVP. But the one thing on the shroud that you didn't bring up, and my brother happens to be a plant pathologist, and this guy on the History Channel brought up, he took these samples using the tape from the center of the shroud, and most of the things you spoke of were taken from the edges, but these were taken from the center, and he proved without a doubt that these plants came from only the area of Jerusalem where he was crucified.
You're talking about Max Fry?
Yes.
Yes, well, I'm telling you that Max Fry took a duplicate set of tapes shoulder to shoulder with the Shroud of Turin Research Project. They were standing together. And Max Fry did say that, he said, well, I use the roller like this, and I press a little harder. And he claimed that he was picking up pollens from between the threads as if they settled down in between threads like gold nuggets or something. That's not what happens. And microscope experts, palynologists, know this is malarkey. These are tiny particles of pollens that cling preferentially anywhere on the cloth. And the idea that he somehow pressed differently or twisted his hand a little differently and got more pollens is ridiculous. But the point I'm making is that even if you believed everything he told you, I'm telling you that the sets of slides that were recovered after his death and that were examined and scrutinized didn't have those pollens. I'm as sorry about it as I can be, but that's the evidence, and I've published it in detail. Walter McCrone found that those pollens were not there. And if you ask the Shroud of Turin Research Project if they ever believed Fry's claims, they never did. They weren't on, those pollens weren't on their tapes. And you cannot, in any case, ask a real pollen expert if you can tell at the pollen level whether a plant came from a particular area, like he was saying, that you could identify it that closely. What he did was he had a route that he wanted to prove to match a theory by Ian Wilson that the Shroud of Turin was the cloth of Edessa, which, by the way, only had a face on it and couldn't be the Shroud of Turin. And he's trying to match up this crackpot theory with pollens. And I think he fudged the evidence big time. I think it's an example of fraud in science.
Okay, back to the calls. Let's go to our next wild card line. Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi. George, Happy New Year quickly.
Thank you.
Okay, and Joe, you know, on some of your matters that you're talking about, we do need people like you to, you know, to bring out the truth on some things. But on some of your subjects you talked about, I have to disagree. Like when you talked about Roswell,
mm-hmm.
I remember as a young child, and it wasn't Discovery Channel because it wasn't out then, they had a good documentary, and they showed, I remember seeing this rod which had strange markings on it. I don't know, have you ever seen that?
Well, the problem when you watch on some of these TV shows and they show you stuff, you have to pay attention that these are recreations and that they've this is not evidence. I'm telling you it is not. There is not a rod that exists that you can go into a museum and examine. This is something people described what they saw. They're describing these balsa sticks, probably with some so-called hieroglyphics. They've been identified as little designs on some of the tape that was used.
No, it wasn't. It was a metal rod, almost like a ruler, and it had very markings.
I know you saw something on a TV show, but I'm telling you, this is a dramatization. They were recreating, obviously, because there is no such...
Well, the last time I saw that metal.
Okay,
I haven't seen it on any...
You tell me where this piece of metal is, and we'll talk further and look to see that it's examined.
One more question, Joe?
It's unknown to the Roswell Museum. They don't have it there. I've been there.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Have you studied on the occult? I don't mean in, but on it. Have you ever?
Oh, sure. Yes, I've looked
into it. Are you not aware of the depth and the manifestations that can come from that? And don't you see, some of these experiences that people have had is real, and it's not just, in a dreamlike state?
No, I've not found any evidence for that. I cannot distinguish much of what's claimed for the occult from ignorance and superstition, and I'm as sorry about it as I can be.
Okay, let's go next to West of the Rockies. Thanks for that call. Go ahead. Hello?
Hi, is that for me?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Okay, this
Hello.
Is Steve calling from Lake Taps, Washington. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to share the reason that I know something way out of the ordinary happened in Roswell. My father, my parents are both 86 years old. I'm 61 and retired. But the year I graduated from high school, I was talking with my dad because in 1958 and 59 and 60, I think, he was Air Force. We were at Patrick Air Force Base, and he was assigned to Cape Canaveral as range safety officer. Naturally, as a young teenager, I had a lot of interest in rockets, spaceships, UFOs, you name it.
Sure.
Well, when I graduated, we were talking, and I mentioned to him that I'd seen a special on the whatever it was at Roswell, and he said, it's kind of interesting. Now, you have to understand, my father was a 20-year Air Force career officer, retired as a colonel, and was straight as an arrow, still is. But he said that he happened, just out of pure coincidence, happened to be headed for Roswell when whatever happened, and he got a radio call that there had been an incident at Roswell and prepare to be diverted, change in assignment. He was instructed to land, and he was flying a C-47. I think that's an old DC-3. But they landed. Their cockpit was covered with canvas tarps. Machine gun-equipped guards were posted both inside and outside the airplane. The airplane was loaded. They were instructed to fly to Wright Field. And I don't know if it was Wright-Patterson or just Wright Field.
At that time, yeah.
Okay. Well, because, he uses shortcuts when he's talking anyway. But he said they landed at Wright Field, where they were joined by machine gun-armed guards.
Yeah.
Their cockpit was covered with canvas tarps.
Yeah.
The airplane was unloaded, and they can tell, pretty much what the weight of the airplane is when you're flying. I know that. They flew back to Roswell. They made three trips,
back
fully loaded to the gills, from Roswell to Wright Field, and were instructed that it had never happened. And, I admit, he didn't see a thing. He didn't see alien bodies. He didn't see a spaceship. He didn't see anything else.
He just knew he was hauling something important.
He knew he was hauling something very important because...
Well, they did take the wreckage. They did take it to Wright Field.
They're going to take a kite or a weather balloon?
Well,
that's a good point.
The people who picked up the debris didn't know what it was. Later, it was misidentified as a weather balloon. It was not a weather balloon, but they looked very much the same. What I can tell you, again, is what Mac Brazel himself described, and you can read it for yourself in the Roswell paper. If Mac Brazel came into town and made up a false description and deliberately didn't tell about the alien beings and the flying saucer, I don't know why he came into town and told the other. This is his first group. He came into town and told this story. And the pictures are there, and they fit his description.
I tell you what, though, that's a great story that we just got there, Joe.
Well, a little misremembering, and somebody saw something being taken to right field. Maybe they misremembered how many trips. Maybe this was a different trip, and they've done what people do all the time. These stories come out of the woodwork. The farther away from the original stories, the more flowering goes on, the more stories are told, and the wilder the stories get. That's not a particularly wild one. But if you go back to the original evidence, you find that it's a different picture entirely.
Indeed. Joe, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure.
We'll work on the great debate, okay?
Okay.
We shall do that post-haste. Whatever you believe. That's Joe Nickel, our special guest. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.